Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints, connecting the dots between our economy, government, and people. And now your hosts, Ted Dabrowski and Mark Glennon.
Mark Glennon from Wirepoints here with my colleague Ted Dabrowski. Tom Bevin is our very special guest today. He is the founder and publisher of Real Clear, as well as a native and resident of Illinois, which gives him a uniquely good perspective on Illinois media and government, both of which we're going to talk about. Real Clear, I hope you know, everybody knows, is the gold standard for aggregating national news and commentary from all perspectives. I would also hope that everybody knows that people on the left shouldn't just be relying on the New York Times, NPR, and whatever else they read. And people on the right, likewise, should not just be watching Fox or Breitbart or whatever. What's the solution? Real Clear. They aggregate the best from every perspective. And since imitation is the best form of flattery, you should know that the news curation that we do at our Wirepoints site was inspired in no small way by Real Clear. Real Clear actually does much more than news aggregation. It has its own original content, its own polling service, averages of national polls is probably the most cited polling statistics in the nation. And a great group of investigative reporters, too, which don't get the attention they deserve. Tom, really great to have you here.
Great to be with you both.
Tom, first tell us about what I was just talking about. Tell us how Real Clear fits into the media today. The media's performance is a national topic, a national scandal, in my opinion. But Real Clear is a breath of fresh air, and I'd like to hear your perspective on why you think your aggregation work, not to belittle the other things you do, but why your aggregation work is particularly important.
Well, you know, we've been at this now for, I mean, it's hard to believe, 22 years. We started the site in 2000, John McIntyre and I, and we were classmates at Princeton, didn't really know each other that well during school, but met here in Chicago afterwards and had this shared affinity for politics. He was a trader. He was down at the SIBO, and I was working at Leo Burnett in advertising. But we were both political junkies, and we got to talking over time. And, you know, this was in the sort of mid 90s or so. And this was right around the time our aha moment, if you will, was when in the mid 90s, there was this time where all of these media publications were going online, and it was the first time you could read what was being written in the LA Times and the New York Times on the same day. Right. And that was our aha moment where we said, listen, let's create a site that aggregates all this great content revolving around politics, policy, and elections, and put it in one place for junkies like us. And again, I mean, one of the things about Real Clear and the reason we called it Real Clear Politics is that neither of us were involved in politics or journalism professionally, right? We were just sort of, you know, again, junkies, but had day jobs. And we also lived in Chicago. We lived outside the Beltway and felt that there was a real opportunity for, a different perspective on an outside the Beltway perspective on politics and news and like. And so that was sort of the crux of the idea. And then, you know, eventually we came up with the Real Clear Politics polling average. And that is, I think, as you mentioned, that's how people came to know us. That's how we became an actual business right around the 2004 election. And it's been a great ride. I mean, we didn't start this with again, this was so long ago. It was before all of the VC stuff and before the internet bubble, really. We started it in April 2000, which is when sort of the first internet bubble started bursting. So it wasn't great timing, but we started it really as sort of a lean, mean operation with just John and I. Again, we were getting up, working on the website, going to our day jobs, trying to, you know, feed our families, then come home, working on the website at night. And, And so eventually, though, we became this media business and media company. We expanded into different, you know, we have all these different verticals now covering, you know, science and history and books and markets and the like, and also became again, sort of like a political clearinghouse, right? A clearinghouse of political news and information. And our initial premise, which remains true today and is even more so now than the day we started. I mean, I remember talking to John, we were talking about the idea that, you know, the internet is really polarized, right? This idea that, you know, you can go to National Review every day for 5 years and never read a liberal opinion. And you can go to, you know, The Nation magazine for 5 years and never read a conservative opinion. But what if you took an article from The Nation and an article from National Review that were on the same subject, put them next to each other and let readers read both those articles and make an informed decision about who they agreed with, who had the better argument, and really sort of be a marketplace of ideas. And so that was our initial premise. And again, today it's even more necessary now as people are so cocooned in their social media bubbles and with their media consumption habits. I mean, it's gotten even worse. And so I think, you know, we find while our work is a lot harder, there are a lot more websites to go to, a lot more ground to cover. What was a sort of, you know, started as sort of a standard 9-to-5-ish type job, you know, with news cycles that started early, started in the morning and ended in the evening, is now a 24/7, you know, insane, crazy thing, which requires a lot more man hours to comb through the information. But at the end of the day, I think what we're doing is even more important, is more important than it's ever been.
It sure is. And doing that aggregation work, as we've learned too, really helps give you a real feel of the pulse of what's going on in the news. Let's talk about Illinois media in particular, which isn't your real specialty, but you are a junkie. I know you follow it, and you've lived here all your life, I guess, except for, well, most of your working life. Democracy doesn't work if the press isn't functioning properly. And in my view, it's not functioning properly for a couple of reasons. They're understaffed, they're under-resourced, pay stinks for journalists, it's hard work doing the original reporting. And at least the state level, in my view, reporters just aren't tough enough. They're pretty lame. I think they do a better job in Chicago, but not at the state level. I assume you agree with some of that. Well, do you agree? And if so, how are we going to fix it?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about the journey that we have been on at Real Clear Politics is going from being, you know, as I mentioned, sort of a casual consumer of news to doing this on a professional basis, day in and day out, and over time, becoming basically part of the news business and a member of the media, even though we're not trained as members of the media. Very enlightening in terms of learning how things operate, but also very disheartening when you really pay attention to how stories are framed, the headlines that they use, the pictures that they use, the way that the words are, you know, loaded words are used, you really do come to appreciate not only the sort of the bias of the left-leaning bias of the national media, but even some local media as well. But also, you know, some of the almost willful dishonesty that takes place. And again, that's something that we've seen that has gotten worse. I think as media, it was a combination of things. One, I think they did not, just over the last decade, did not, again, I'm talking about the national media. I'll get to your question on the local media because I think it's important too. But as you watch the national media take a president like Barack Obama, who they clearly
had affinity for, and give him the kind of soft, glowing coverage day in and day out, and then contrast that immediately with Donald Trump and the way the media effectively treated him as a hostile entity, and they became part of the resistance. That the media's credibility, I think, has suffered greatly because of the way that they, in some cases, really lowered their standards and threw out a lot of the, I would say, industry practices that older school journalists like Carl Cannon, who's our Washington bureau chief, for example, he just joked about it this morning. He said, I'm the last of the bison, right? Like, he's an old school guy. His father, Lou Cannon, covered Reagan for the Washington Post. I mean, he has been in Washington for, he's covered four or five presidents. He's been in Washington since he was 16 when his dad moved there. And he's constantly just appalled by the way that these once prestigious institutions like the Washington Post, which is his hometown paper, just absolutely, debase themselves on a near daily basis in favor of making, ideological, partisan, political points. So that's been an interesting part of our journey. And as it relates to living here and watching that same thing take place in Illinois, I mean, you definitely have seen over the same time that we were experiencing, growth and people were moving online, you've seen just the absolute decimation of the journalism industry and the entire business model. And everybody has struggled to come to grips with that. We watched how it's affected, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, and even local papers. I think local has made, hyper local, has made a little bit of a comeback, and that's encouraging because people always want to have, good information about things that are going on around them in their daily lives. And I think maybe it's social media, but people are sort of more attuned these days to things like, the latest school board meeting, what happened the other day, and things of that nature that you can only really get from a hyper-local type of news organization. But it certainly is the case that, state papers, city papers they've struggled. I mean, they've lost a lot of resources. It's made it hard. They've been, essentially whittled down to now they carry, AP headlines, all syndicated stuff to cover a lot. They've closed bureaus and the like. And then there's the other piece of it, which is, to your point, Mark, a lot of these institutions have also, as with the national ones, grown more liberal over time. I mean, you guys know John Cass. He's a good friend of mine. He's on my radio show all the time. And he watched the Trib newsroom go woke over time. And when you have that happen and there is no diversity of thought within newsrooms, and there are no sort of countervailing options for people to get a different perspective, it is especially in and this is true in a lot of cities. I mean, in a one-party town like Chicago, to have a press that's not skeptical, that's not curious, that is not does not hold those in power to account. It's a recipe for disaster. I mean, it's a recipe for corruption and bad policies and all sorts of things. And I think Illinois and the city of Chicago in particular have suffered from that over time.
Tom, Ted here, you've covered the difficulties of Chicago Tribune, Sun-Times, et cetera. But, you mentioned the local has a little bit of a revival, but my concern has been that they're reviving on the kind of the fun stuff, the easy to consume stuff. But when it comes down to, that local reporter who now not only reports, but has to have a camera probably on his or her shoulder trying to do the whole thing. Right. Our concern at Mark and I have been that a lot of these people can't open up the financial documents of a city or a school district. They can't analyze it. It gets tougher and tougher to FOIA. So not only might their inclinations be to not write about the things that matter because from a political perspective, but they just may not have the skill set to do it. And again, I'm not trying to belittle those people. It's just you're asking a lot from people now to cover things where, like in Illinois, let's talk about Illinois, you know, second highest property taxes in the country, you know, the crime we've talked about. We've talked about home values that have been falling, you know, prior to COVID. These are real difficult times for a lot of our cities, pension debts. So it's a lot to ask of people. How the hell do we get that kind of coverage locally in a way that means anything?
Great question. And again, I, you know, you guys are the expert on Illinois and some of those issues, but I'll take it back to the national level. It's very similar. I mean, you know, again, Carl and I have had this conversation hundreds of times. There was a point not too long ago, maybe 20 years ago when we first started, where, you know, covering a presidential campaign was the capstone of a career spent in journalism. I mean, you worked your entire career to be able to get on the campaign plane or bus, right? It was the David Broders of the world to cover those things, right? Who had come up covering courts and, you know, local courts and city hall and things like that, made their way to the national desk, made their way, you know, onto that. And at some point, and it was pretty dramatic. I mean, the because all these institutions were fighting these cost-cutting measures, they basically hired kids right out of college, shoved a camera in their hand and said, you know, go follow John Kerry around and let us know if there's any news. And in one sense, it was good because you were able to get, you know, you were able to get more sort of information about what the candidates were doing. You'd know if John Kerry changed something in his stump speech from one stop to the next. So the sort of incremental small ball stuff, you know, that John Kerry had a run-in with a protester or something like that. But the trade-off was you lost massive institutional knowledge. You had these kids, they didn't know, they couldn't even tell you, you know, anything about Bill Clinton, let alone some of these candidates or any of the, you know, presidential history, any of that stuff. And again, it's not a knock on these kids. It's just it was the economics that drove that shift in coverage. And I think there's been some of that, too. I mean, the model has been, you know, because you were paying these institutions were paying these elder statesmen, you know, a lot of money. And they had to cut costs. And so the easiest way to do that is to buy those guys out, force them out, have them retire, let them go, and hire a kid right out of college that you can pay a third or a quarter or a fifth of what they were paying and have them go down and say, you know, go cover City Hall. Well, yes, you've got someone covering City Hall, but they don't know anything about City Hall or the history of City Hall. And to your point, they don't know how to, they don't know the ins and outs of doing that job. FOIA requests and you know they don't have the Rolodex, they don't have the sources. And so again, you're getting coverage, but and you may in some sense be getting again incremental coverage that you wouldn't have gotten before, but the trade-off is you've lost a ton of historical context and institutional knowledge that helps put those stories in context for readers. And that, you know, that was important stuff.
Tom, let's go on to the actual politics in Illinois beyond the media. As you know better than anybody else, Americans are really mad right now. And it's increasingly, it is directed at the radical left. They may only be 25 or 30% of America, but they run all the federal government except the Supreme Court. It's going to be reflected in the midterm elections. We know that. But what about in Illinois? We're behind the curve on that. Is it happening here? And what do you think the chances are that people are going to get fed up here and start throwing people out?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, Illinois is, it has happened. It happened in 2010 here, where Republicans had a very good night and won a bunch of House seats and Senate and the like. So it can happen. We've grown even just since that in the last, you know, decade plus, even more tribal and partisan in our politics, which when you're in a state that has more Democrats than Republicans, and those Democrats are locked in to voting for Democrats, makes it harder to get those kinds of swings. But we'll see. I mean, you know, there's plenty of indication in swing states around the country that, yes, this frustration, we've seen stories and focus groups about suburban women in particular who had sided with Democrats in 2018, 2020, and now because of, whether it's crime, whether it's education, whether it's COVID restrictions, whatever, have broken ranks with Democrats and are moving back into the Republican column. So I think it is absolutely the case that we could see a situation where Democrats could have a rough night in Illinois. Now, will that make it all the way to, J.B. Pritzker at the top of the ticket? We'll see. I mean, we will see. He's going to spend whatever he has to spend to win re-election. We'll see who the Republican nominee is and how well they handle the political landscape. So there are a lot of questions to be determined. But is it possible that there's a red wave forming out there that could wash away some congressional Democrats and even the governor himself? Absolutely, it's possible. I mean, there's still a lot of time left, but there are indications right now when you look at things like the right track, wrong track number nationally, it's just off the charts bad. The generic congressional ballot, which, you know, Republicans have been posting big numbers, which usually they don't even lead in that metric. They're up about 3 points now in our average. So all of the makings are there for a big red wave in November. But again, a lot can happen between now and then.
What's your sense, Tom, for what the big issues will be in Illinois? We've talked to you about doing our own poll with you on this topic, but save us some money and tell us what your gut is.
Look, the big issue in Illinois, the big issues here are the big issues that are around the country, which is, you know, I mean, it's easy. It's inflation, it's economy. It's still COVID to a certain degree. And the other education, immigration, crime, healthcare is still there. And voting rights is another one. I mean, here's the problem for Democrats. I mean, their voting rights, when you look at and there were just a couple of polls out of Georgia, I was just looking at the data. And this is where Democrats, I think, run a risk of it's an important issue for the base of the party. You need the base of a party in a midterm election, right? You have to turn out your base. However, you cannot turn out your base while at the same time alienating swing voters, moderates, independents, right? And that seems to be what's been happening with Democrats because, I'm going to use the numbers for Georgia, okay? But Democrats, I think 34% of Democrats, so one out of every three Democrats said election voting rights and election issues were the number one issue for them. Number one, that was like 3.5 times what independents thought, right? Or twice what independents thought. Meanwhile, the number one issue for independents was the economy and inflation. And they were 3.5 times more concerned than Democrats were. So to the extent that Democrats' priorities are misaligned with where the rest of the electorate is, they run the risk of spending too much time, putting too much emphasis and urgency on that issue, ignoring, at least it perception-wise in the minds of voters, that they're spending so much time on that. They're not spending enough time on the things that we care about, which, again, are the economy and inflation. And that's when you'll find voters, you know, shun Democrats and move toward other options. I think the same is true here in Illinois. To the extent it's inflation, you know, COVID's a thing. If we truly are on the downslope of Omicron and the pandemic gets better and people are able to return to normalcy, that's going to help Democrats a great deal. But if they don't get a handle on inflation, they're still in, I think, a good deal of political peril moving forward.
Hey, Tom, so it seems like we're always an extreme outlier nationally on so many things in Illinois, right? From the finances to the COVID restrictions to I can go on and on. You know, that's what we find at Wire Points. So every statistic you pull up, we're extreme outliers. So, you know, a lot of people thought, well, you know, hey, look what happened in Virginia. Youngkin pulled it off. People are ticked off. When we had our elections, local elections back in April of last year, we didn't get any motion. People, you know, hardly anybody showed up for the school board meetings. Nothing changed. And so there's a concern here that Illinois is not going to react and it's not going to behave in the same way like you're talking about Georgia or Virginia or other places. And again, it comes back to us being an extreme outlier. What the hell is the difference here? You live in Illinois, so that makes it special. You're sitting in the middle of all that aggregation. You're sitting in the middle of all that, you know, polling data. Tell the people, why are we so different? What's up with us?
That's a good question. I mean, you know,
is it historical? Is it cultural? Why are we different?
You know, I think it is, it's a combination of things because, you know, you look at the cycle of these things and it wasn't so long ago. I mean, I guess it was a while now, but, you know, that Illinois was a bellwether. It was a swing state. I mean, that it was competitive. And that really, I think that changed around in a significant way. Illinois took a sort of a solid blue turn in the early 90s. Bill Clinton won the suburbs and really sort of from that moment on, even while, you know, Wisconsin and Iowa stayed razor and still even are to a certain degree. I was obviously moved way to the right. But there were a couple of election cycles in a row, 2000, 2004, where both of those states were decided by, you know, 10, 12,000 votes. And they kind of moved for Obama. Then they moved back toward Republicans during the Trump era. But Illinois has, to your point, has stayed sort of consistently, almost religiously deep blue. Why is that? You know, it's hard to explain. I mean, I think part of it is you've had people of, let's say, more independent or Republican persuasion moving to places like Indiana or further south or up to Wisconsin or wherever. So I think population loss has probably, you know, deepened the issue. You've got a one party, Illinois' Republican Party has been so bad for so long that there's no bench. There's never been they don't have a good farm team. You look at some of these other states like Florida, for example, very robust Republican Party. Even Wisconsin, you know, they've been going sort of hand-to-hand political combat in Wisconsin for I don't know, 10, 12 years with the recall of the governors and the Supreme Court nominee and all that stuff, right? But the Republican Party has been pretty robust in finding and turning out its voters. Here, it feels like the Republican Party has just sort of atrophied to the point where it doesn't even have muscles that it can flex anymore, right? And that's been, they haven't done a good job of recruiting candidates because there aren't that many great candidates you know, at the local level. And so it's a combination of things, but it certainly is the case that this state is now, I mean, that's the other thing too. When you get to a point where it becomes a lost cause, right? It's sort of a vicious cycle, right? National Republicans, you know, they're not putting money in Illinois. They're not putting money into maybe a congressional candidate here, but they're not backing Senate candidates here. You got to have or governor's candidates, you got to have a self-funded billionaire like Bruce Rauner if you want to be competitive. Because otherwise, there's no base of money here. It becomes a, you know, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that, that, you know, you become, you get bluer and bluer every single cycle. And that's where we find ourselves.
Tom, another pernicious driver of public opinion is social media. This is, you're in Illinois and across the country. We have this now enormous problem, in my view, of censorship by Facebook, Twitter, or others. Basically control the narrative, which I think has a huge impact on not just the presidential elections, but everything down ballot. This is a pretty heavy question, but and you're a thoughtful guy. So, you know, what are we going to do about that? The Twitters and Facebooks, you know, they're being encouraged by Democrats in Congress to do more censorship. They seem to be getting more aggressive. I wouldn't be surprised if, given their success in the last presidential cycle, they'll be still more aggressive in the coming cycle. You know, this kind of applies to Real Clear and Wire Points, too, in that somebody theoretically could ask us, you know, you post articles that you don't like, you know, maybe from, you know, other sources, as do we. We print things from Jacobin, the socialist magazine, and we're, you know, often thinking that it's all garbage, but it's, you know, an important perspective to see. Where do you draw the line on these things? Do you think maybe the First Amendment should be extended to protect people from censorship? That would be a big jump for courts, but it's a possibility that they would, even though they recognize that these are private companies we're talking about, that the First Amendment could be extended to them. But generally speaking, do you have any thoughts about how to bring neutrality back to the internet?
Well, I mean, that is a big question. It's an important question, but it is a tough question because, and it's one that I think a lot of people are coming to grips with and trying to figure out what the best way forward. There's no question that these social media companies are engaging in censorship. I mean, they just are. I'm trying to think of one case where it was a liberal organization or individual that got censored. I mean, it's almost always conservatives. There's no question that you look back at the 2020 election and what, you know, Twitter did to the New York Post over the Hunter Biden laptop story. I mean, they were putting their fingers on the scales of that election to protect, you know, people from seeing stories that they felt were going to damage Joe Biden. I mean, that's just a fact. So what can be done about it? I mean, there's talk, as you mentioned, of Section, you know, 230 in Congress. You know, it's interesting because the progressives are talk, you know, there's talk of wanting to break up these giant, you know, monopolies, but like, you know, Google and Amazon and Facebook. But to your point, at the same time, there are the same people, Elizabeth Warren and others who are on the progressive left, who are actively pushing and encouraging more censorship from these companies when it comes to you know, what they call misinformation. And that's really the crux of it. I mean, who gets to decide what's misinformation and what's an alternative point of view? And you know, companies, if you're a private company, obviously you should have the right to publish what you want or not publish what you want. And so that makes it difficult as well. But these have become so integral to our, it's as if they're the public square, right? And we saw what happened with Donald Trump. When you are excised, when you are banned from participating in, you know, on Twitter or Facebook, you lose a substantial voice in the public square. And so, look, it's a thorny question. I don't have any good answers. I agree with the premise of your question, though, which is I think something has to be done, because I consider myself, you know, sort of a free speech absolutist. The answer to discourse that you find uncomfortable is not less discourse. It is more discourse, right?
You got it.
Yep. And people should be allowed to say whatever they want. Register their opinions, and people should be able to, and that's the business that we're in sort of a, you know, much smaller scale. We're publishing a variety of opinions. As you mentioned, we publish a ton of stuff every day that we don't agree with, or I personally don't agree with. But we're trying to find the best arguments from a wide variety of voices, and put them together in one place so people can educate themselves, you know, read, spend the time, make up their own minds, and be better, more informed citizens. It doesn't mean they have to agree with everything that they read. But this idea that has taken hold that somehow, you know, an alternate point of view should not be seen or heard at all. And you look at what's been going on with the vaccine debates with, you know, folks like Peter McCullough and Dr. Malone. The idea that these gentlemen who 18 months ago, 24 months ago, were considered experts in their field, don't even get to, like, you can't even hear their opinion. It's verboten. You can't, they're not allowed to speak on subject of, you know, virology and vaccines and the like is insane. You may not agree with them. You may think they're lying or they're cranks or they're wackos or whatever, but like the idea that they're not allowed and you're going to wipe them from the conversation is just, to me, just so wrong. And it does require some sort of remedy. I just don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. From the top down, I mean, Google itself was censoring searches on the Great Barrington Declaration. That's bunch of signatories, a group of the leading dissenters from sort of the mainstream approach on COVID led by scholars from Oxford, Stanford, Harvard. And you couldn't find it on Google.
Right.
And this does happen in
French
Illinois.
Characters from Stanford and Harvard.
Yeah, yeah, and this does affect Illinois too. Paul Vallis was recently knocked off of Facebook for a week and a half. Didn't get hardly any coverage in the media. This is another thing. The media used to be such a fine champion of freedom of speech. Now they're pretty delighted with this. I don't know. You know, it's partially that they're perhaps trying to protect their monopoly too. I think there's an economic self-interest in it. But we're going to be writing about that Vallis affair, and it's not the first time Center Square has had problems because it leans a little bit right. And we should point out too, you personally, I think it's fair to say, are right of center, but that does not show up in the story selection that you shows up in your aggregation work.
Let me add just one thing in there real quick. Critique a little bit, Tom, too, though, because you know, there's a free market out there in theory, right? And so we may not like what's happening. I certainly don't like what's happening with the censorship and all that. What's up with groups being able to, if people are so dissatisfied with that, you would think then that there's a big customer demand for somebody who comes in like a Real Clear, right? So Real Clear, but now the social media version, and comes in right under all these other guys and steals market. Why can't that happen? And the obvious answer is those other guys are so huge that. But you would think then, well, then maybe that people aren't that dissatisfied. We don't like it, but we keep doing it. So what's the issue there, right? That you would think somebody like a Real Clear could come right in there and scoop up market share.
Yeah, I mean, there was this idea that folks on the left and folks in the media said, well, you know, if you don't like Twitter, start your own. If you don't like Facebook, start your own. And then conservatives did that. And it wasn't Getter. It was the one before that. I'm forgetting the name.
Yeah, Parler, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, Parler. And what happened? Amazon shut down their servers. And, you know, I mean, it was just like, are you kidding? So that kind of stuff is happening though. I mean, there's Getter now, there's Rumble. You've got, you know, Substack is you've got alternative voices on Substack that are getting attention. So that stuff is happening. The problem is it takes time, and those are green shoots, and it will take time for them to mature and be in a position where they can, you know, get on a sort of level footing with these behemoths that are Twitter and Facebook. And in the meantime, right, what happens in the meantime? In the meantime, the censorship seems to be getting more aggressive. The willingness to try and influence elections seems to be, you know, control information for some sort of partisan advantage seems to be, you know, there was evidence of that in 2020. I suspect we'll see more of it in 2024. So, you know, maybe it takes 10, 15 years for some of these smaller groups to get to a point where they have the reach and the ability to be a counterbalance, a counterweight for folks like that. But it's going to take a long time. And in the meantime, you know, I just think that where we are now and where we're headed is it's not good for it's not good for the country. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for our civic life. And so I think something has to be done.
Yeah, I guess the big concern for me always is, you know, we have to be careful that we don't set some precedent where we ask big government to step in again. And so this is a real tough spot for us, right? Because
totally agree.
It's agree. A mess. Even, what's happening? Again,
unintended consequences, the best of intentions, whatever. Yeah. Look, it's a very tricky issue. It's a hard one. It's not going to. But I think there might be some opportunity for consensus to do something. And hopefully that, again, these are for-profit businesses. And to the extent they continue to see their market share go elsewhere, that will help regulate their behavior as well. So theoretically.
Yeah. Well, you know, Tom, that's been our experience, is that people do want to see that kind of neutrality in the news that's reported to them. And that's what's no doubt driven your site to, you know, routinely being listed among the top 20 news sites in the nation. It baffles me, you know, how CNN, MSNBC could stick to their model of pandering to such a small part of the universe instead of just pursuing a neutral model, which media organizations used to do. I mean, I wonder what goes on in the board of directors meetings at the parent companies. I mean, they're losing readership. It's obvious that people don't like this, and I just don't get it as a profit maximization issue.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that, but I also think there was a period in, look, we've been going through a great sorting that has been taking place in this country for a long time, 40 years, 50 years. Pew has done some research on this, which, you know, you go back to like 1992 and they asked, you know, how do you feel about people from the opposite party? And, you know, those numbers have, the number of people now who dislike members of the opposite party has skyrocketed, right? And you've probably heard some of this stuff. Like, you know, one of the things now is they asked a question about marrying someone from the opposite party. And now a majority of folks don't want their kids to marry someone from the opposite political party. So this polarization that's been taking place, this tribalism, if you will, that's been taking place in the country, it vastly predates you know, Donald Trump or even Barack Obama. It's been taking place. But with the advent of cable news media in 96, when Fox came on the scene and MSNBC came on the scene, and suddenly CNN was left there, you know, in the middle feeling pressure as they're watching these other companies. And then you throw on top of that social media, which has intensified the tribal aspect of this and really is now in some respects the one of the main drivers of cable news. That's where they get their show ideas. They watch Twitter and see what the outrage of the day is, and then that becomes the segment on their broadcast. So all of these things have intensified the pressures that everybody's under in terms of trying to garner eyeballs and views and clicks. People do say they want objective, nonpartisan news. But, you know, I can tell you, having done this for 20 years, and they constantly say they want that, but you put a, an objective news story up next to, you know, another story about, you know, God knows what, whatever the, you know, Ilhan Omar or, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene or something. And that story will do 5 or 10 times the number of clicks the objective news story will do. And that's been a problem with news as well for a long time. And so I think one of the reasons CNN, they ended up having getting out of the sort of standard news business. And I think it's hurt their brand. And now you look at them because they're still seen as sort of that, but they're sandwiched between MSNBC and Fox. And so they're kind of caught in a no man's land, and they're kind of, now they're half opinion or more with Don Lemon and you know, well, what was Chris Cuomo, but, and then they've got some of their folks who are the sort of news guys, and their ratings have suffered for it.
Hey, Tom, I've got one last question that I was curious to hear when you started. I wish I'd asked it earlier. You know, I remember when I first discovered Real Clear, it's like so cool to have access to all this stuff, and I don't even remember what year that was, but I really, really enjoyed it. What was, you mentioned you had an aha moment, and I don't know if it's a cool story or not, but what was that aha moment you had with your partner? And, you know, and how did you, was it like, this is it, we got it, or let's just do something here and try it out?
Yeah, no, it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't a particular story. It was just the aha moment was just, hey, you know, I just saw what someone wrote in the LA Times, and oh, here's a story in the New York Times. And it was the first time that you could read that stuff and sort of see what everybody was writing all around the country. Right. And that was really it, which was, okay, let's put all that stuff in one place for people. And, you know, one of the reasons we succeeded as a business, I think it was, you know, it was partially luck. It was partially, our insight. But it was also that at that time, this was pre-blogosphere, this was pre-everything, there was a sense from the major media organizations that they were absolutely, I mean, we could have been shut down, not shut down, but we could have been run out of business if the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or any of these other sites that had, you know, 10,000 times the resources and manpower that we had, because it was just me and John, I mean, literally, would have decided to copy our model and start aggregating content. But the thing was, at that point, when the internet was in its sort of infancy, everybody, all these media organizations were viewing it as sort of there was a finite readership out there. So they would never, the New York Times would never link to their arch enemy, the Washington Post. Why would they send readers to the Washington Post? That's insane. We would never do that. And the Washington Post would never send readers. They wanted to keep readers for themselves. They didn't see the value in sending readers everywhere else. And so we were able to appear as this, you know, cheat sheet or clearinghouse or whatever you want to call it, where people could come to a site, they could go off to the Washington Post, come back, go to the New York Times, come back, go to the Wall Street Journal, come back, go to National Review, go wherever you want. But they would always return. And that's one of the ways that we ended up forming, a small but growing but exceedingly loyal readership. I mean, our stats from the beginning, I think 75 or 73/4 of our readers have our site bookmarked, and is one of the three sites, first sites they go to every single morning.
That would be me. That's me, Tom, twice a day.
So in that sense, we kind of became, and this sounds a little hokey, but like America's homepage, right? Like it was a starting point for people who want to get a quick take on, okay, what happened? I'm just getting up. You know, what happened yesterday? I was traveling, or, you know, what happened overnight? I want to be able to see quickly who wrote what. What the latest polls are, what the latest, you know, news stories are, what the latest videos, you know, what are the controversies, whatever. And that's what we provided. And again, in the early environment, now this has since changed, obviously, and people have recognized that the pie is not finite, it's infinite. And that you can actually garner more viewers by providing them, bringing, you know, interesting, valuable information to their attention that they will not, you know, click on that link and never return, that they're going to keep coming back. They're going to come back more often than ever. And this was the Matt Drudge model. I mean, this is sure. what he did sure. and was hugely successful at it.
Tom, it's terrific to see an entrepreneur doing well while they're doing good. Stay the course. We're really grateful that you joined us here, and we'll talk to you next time on The Dialogue by Wirepoints. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. Guys. Appreciate it.